Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This week, people from around the world who love movies and who make movies are gathering in Champaign-Urbana for the 10th annual Roger Ebert's Film Festival. The festival gets underway tonight with a showing of the 1996 version of Hamlet, directed by Kenneth Branagh and starring Kenneth Branagh in the title role. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking with an actor who appears in that movie and a lot of other movies as well. Our guest for this hour is Timothy Spall. He's made many movies. He's performed on television, in television drama and comedy. He's acted on the stage, and he's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana to take part in the festival, and we're pleased that he could spend a little time talking with us this morning. He has, as I said, been in many movies. He worked a number of times with the British director Mike Leigh in films including Life is Sweet, Secrets and Lies, Topsy Turvy, All or Nothing. He also appeared in the Sheltering Sky, in Hamlet, as I mentioned. Some of the other movies include Vanilla Sky, Rockstar, The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. He's been in the Harry Potter films, Prisoner of Azkaban, and one other, The Goblet of Fire, and will be in some forthcoming films. Recently, he starred in a Disney feature, Enchanted. He was in the recent version of Sweeney Todd, and also appeared recently in a new updated version of A Room with a View that was shown on public television, and just recently here on our station it was shown, and in that he appears with his son, Rafe. He's also acted for television. He's acted on stage, and we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us this morning. Questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in and talk with Timothy Spall. You can do that by picking up the telephone and dialing the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, or if you'd be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can give us a call. We just ask people to try to be brief in their comments, just so we could keep things moving along. But certainly anybody's welcome to call. Mr. Spall, hello.
Hi there.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
No, my pleasure.
I think probably almost everything that I have read about you talks about how, as a teenager, you were bitten by the acting bug and decided that was something that you really wanted to try to do. Would you tell that story about your first acting experience?
Well, my first acting experience, I suppose, was I did a school play as a very young child, and that was just a load of fun. And then when I was about 13, 14, I actually, and this isn't on stage, this is actually under the high-rise council flat that my grandmother used to live in. I took her home one day, and I saw this old man walking along. He was bent over, and he was shuffling, and it was cold. It was a bit of a bleak landscape, and I, for some reason, without knowing why I was doing it, not to take the mickey out of him because there was nobody there, when he'd gone, I started walking like him and trying to feel what he was going through, how he felt. And that was the first time I ever thought, actually, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I eventually did a school play. I played the lion in The Wizard of Oz in my secondary school when I was 16, and my drama teacher, who was a very nice woman, said, "It's a horrible, stinking, rotten job, and I've never encouraged any of my acting students to do it before because it's so cruel, but I think you should be an actor." That's all I needed to hear.
And she was the one that suggested that you go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
Yeah, she did. Well, she suggested I should go to drama school. Hmm. But she also suggested maybe I should try and get some exams. So I went to college first. I joined the National Youth Theatre, which is a national organisation in England, which is a summer school of theatre where about 300 kids get together and do plays to a high standard. And then I actually, at the age of 18, auditioned for RADA, Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and got in at 19. And Bob's your uncle. That was the beginning.
Yeah. I would imagine that going to the acting camp for kids could have been a difficult experience in the sense that hanging around with a bunch of teenagers who either think they're actors or want to be actors could be annoying in the extreme.
Well, there is a little bit of lifestyle going on, you know. You know, who's going to buy the T-shirt? Let's get a T-shirt and then run around in that rather bogus theatrical way. But on the whole, it was such an unpretentious organization. It was run by invented by a man called Michael Croft, who decided he would audition from every background. You know, as you know, our Britain is a far more class-conscious country than America. So there was kids from private schools, kids from, like, where I came from a state school, like a, you know, what you would call a, I don't know what the equivalent of it is, but it's certainly free and supplied by the government. And there were kids from Eton and Harrow, which are top schools. And so it was a real melting pot, and mainly the main drive and the main concentration was on doing the shows. And, I mean, I ended up playing Falstaff at the age of 17 in Henry IV, Part 1, which was quite a shock.
Yeah. Well, how do you play Falstaff is obviously a great character, and I'm sure that it's an invitation probably for a lot of actors to take it over the top. Yeah. Maybe that's just Falstaff is an over-the-top character. How do you play Falstaff at 17?
Well, I mean, I think I go back to what I was talking about the doing the old man. It's almost like it wasn't a conscious, I must do this because I need to act, I need to be famous. It was a desire to try and portray how people actually are and how they feel. And obviously at that age, I was working completely off my instinct. And I hadn't had much education in Shakespeare. In fact, virtually zero. All I'd done was just read Twelfth Night at school at a very low level. And so there I was, actually speaking this incredible language, not understanding half of it. Obviously, I understood a lot of it by the I was educated by doing it, and actually just played it to try and find out what the man was. And, you know, obviously there's fun to be had in those characters. He is a larger-than-life character, but there's a great deal of soul to him. You know, there's a great deal of contradictory qualities in him, and I think, you know, an experience like that really made me understand, you know, that it's more than just standing up and showing off, really.
Yeah. You certainly have had the opportunity to play a wide range of characters, but are particularly known for playing, let's say, working class people.
Yeah.
Is there a particular kind of character that you would say maybe more than any other, or some aspect of character that the different characters have that you would say, now this is the kind of thing that I really enjoy getting into and trying to put on the stage or on the screen?
Yeah, there's on the ISBDM thing, it says I play a lot of working class characters. I mean, I have done, and I often do play what would be regarded as everyman characters. I've also done my fair share of kings and princes and various upper class ponces that aren't, so you couldn't regard as being a lump and proletariat. Yeah. But I suppose what happens is that I've got, you know, with my association I've had with Mike Lee, I've kind of grown up with him, worked with him over 25 years, actually, on various projects. And Mike's very interested in giving people that wouldn't usually get centre stage in films a crack of the fair crack of the whip. So his characters tend to be, the leading roles tend to be the characters that would be, peripheral characters in other more mainstream shows. He gives the ordinary guy, the guy that you would ignore wouldn't give the time of day to, he gives him the center stage. So, and then explores what makes him tick. And I suppose that I find very, very interesting, the poetry and the sense of drama that is in everyday, which is what Mike Lee is kind of preoccupied with mainly in his work, apart from many other things. He does dig into the soul of people that, you know, often aren't represented in other areas.
How many of his films have you acted in?
I think it's five.
Four? I was going to say, yeah, four or five.
I think I've done five. Yeah, I did four movies, one TV film and a stage play. So six times I've worked with him.
Yeah. That seems to be the kind of experience that probably not that many actors get. That is to work more than one time with a particular director and maybe in a sense become part of what you might call that director's repertory.
Yeah, I mean, there are people, aren't there? You have directors like that here. You've got, you know, Scorsese often works with the same people, and as does Tim Burton, obviously, with Johnny Depp being his main protagonist and muse, really. So it's a great privilege, actually, and it's a great way of building up a relationship, and a tacit relationship, almost. It's not like you discuss overtly what you're going to come up with, because, you know, Mike Leigh has a very particular way of working with improvisations and so on and so forth. But, you know, getting to know somebody over, you know, I've been married 27 years this year, and I've worked with Mike 27 years, so it's a tandem sort of relationship. And you get a sense of both knowing we don't want to repeat ourselves in the character, we want to try something else. We both realize, you know, that the process has become subtler, and we also have a great deal of fun, you know. And he is a hard taskmaster, Mike Leigh. He pushes himself no harder than, well, more than anybody else, actually. And it's a very difficult and fundamentally fulfilling but hard process. It's a great thing to have that kind of relationship with somebody. He's become a very good friend as well. So hopefully there'll be a tap on the door one of these days, you know.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Timothy Spall. He's acted in many films, also in the stage and on television. Just to mention some of his recent work on public television, just many stations showed, and ours certainly did recently, A Room with a View, in which he performed with his son, Rafe. He also was in the recent film version of Sweeney Todd in Enchanted. He's acted in a couple of the Harry Potter films. He was in Lemony Snicket's series of Unfortunate Events. He was in The Last Samurai. He was in Vanilla Sky. He has performed a number of these movies, as he said, directed by the British director Mike Leigh. He is here, that is, Mr. Spall is here, to take part in Roger Ebert's Film Festival in its 10th edition. The very first film is Hamlet. That will be shown tonight at 7 o'clock. If you don't already have tickets, chances are you're not going to be able to see it on the big screen, but it is a film that you can go out and rent and you can take a look at. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you want to just take a moment to say something about the Hamlet that they will show tonight?
Yeah, this is a quite extraordinary thing, really. This was Ken Branagh's project to do the most complete version of Hamlet ever done. It's every extant piece of writing that Shakespeare ever done. I don't know if people know, but often when they do Hamlet on stage and screen, they adapt it and cut quite a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Ken Branagh's achievement in managing to. It's actually a very long movie. It's 4 hours, and that's how long the sort of definitive version of Hamlet would always going to be. And it's got the most incredible cast. It's got, obviously, Mr. Branagh as Hamlet. It's got Charlton Heston as the player King. It's got Billy Crystal as a gravedigger, Robin Williams as Osric. It's got Rosemary Harris. It's got Kate Winslet. It's got Jack Lemmon. That's just a few. Gerard Depardieu, Richard Briers. It's an incredible feast of a movie. But it's also a very... it's played with a very, very straight bat, to use a cricket analogy. It means that it's a very clear and succinct production, very, very clearly told and concentrating very much on the story. It's set in a sort of 19th century period, and it's beautifully shot by Alex Thompson. And it's a long haul, but I remember when I saw it, I can't remember thinking it was anywhere near 4 hours, but it was a great thing to have worked on.
Yeah. I expect that for a long time, maybe even still now, a lot of people in Britain will remember you for this television series that you made in the 80s, off Wiedersehen, Pat.
Oh, that's right. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And I'm interested, I want to ask you about it because, and again, in some of the things that I've read about you, it said that at that period of your life and your career, you became so identified with that show and with the character that you played that you couldn't get other work because other directors saw you and they saw the character that you played, and Barry Taylor.
That's right, yeah. He was a particular particular type of character that he was called Boring Barry from Birmingham. He was a motorbike enthusiast, and he was a peasant, and he spoke in a very particular way that bored everybody sick, and I became stricken with that appellation for quite a few years. But it was a huge hit in England in the 80s. It was about the construction workers who had to leave Thatcher's Britain because there was no work. It was during our terrible recession period, and had to go and work in Germany and live in a hut on the building site. So you've got immediately the prison camp analogy with these seven different guys, all from different working class backgrounds, all from different parts of England, different towns, and with different football rivalries and different regional prejudices, and it's all about their camaraderie and their ability or inability to live in Germany. And so you had that whole sort of Second World War kind of the Great Escape kind of thing, in with this fact that they were all out there getting sloshed on the German lager, and it went down incredibly well. We did two series of it, two seasons, you call it, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And it's still people, 25-year-olds run up to me and say, my dad's one of your favourite actors. Or the other way around, you're one of my dad's favourite actors, I should have said. And, it was a weird one. You know, I was 26 years old. I had two kids, one on the way, three kids actually, and I was really, really famous. I'd be walking down the street by a bottle of milk from the local shop, and people would shout out, "What the bloody hell are you doing here? I thought you lived over in the West End." I said, "No, I live around here, mate." So I was very, very famous and very, very unemployed, which is not a nice combination.
And it was, it was Mike Lee who really turned things around for you at that time. Was that when you made Life is Sweet?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'd worked with him before then. I did a TV film with him before I did this Our Vida's Ain't Pet. And then he asked me to come and do, yes, Life is Sweet. I'd also started to do, gone back to the theatre and gone back to the National Theatre and done a Molière play. And I did another series called Frank Stubbs, which was, again, a popular series about a ticket scout, I think you call them. You know, the guys who sell you tickets outside stadiums for overinflated prices, who decided he wanted to be an entrepreneur. And the woeful tale of his various forays into trying to be an agent and entrepreneur. So I'd started to dig myself out of it. But then Mike asked me to come and do Life is Sweet, which was one of his movies previously to Secrets and Lies that became, on the art circuit here, quite well known. It won some awards, the LA Critics Award, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it was the beginning of a kind of being sucked out of that dreadful thing of being typecast. I was doing this film. I did this Ken Russell film, and the producer said to the hairdresser, "I'm a bit worried. Do you think Tim can do anything other than a Birmingham accent?" She said, "A, he's an actor, and B, he's from bloody London." You know, I mean, so even that's the kind of prejudice that you were kind of trying to fight back at the time. You know, it's a funny thing. Maybe it's been, I don't know, shot by your own success. You get, maybe people thought I was that character, but it's, you know, in the end, it's part of your career and part of life's experience. You either get over it or you don't. You know, and I think being choosy and trying to concentrate on what is important to you, work choices you make, is an important way of digging yourself out of it.
Yeah, that was Gothic.
Yeah, Gothic indeed. Yes.
And you also were in Quadrophenia. That was directed by Ken Russell too, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't actually. That was Tommy. Ken Russell directed Tommy. Frank Rodham directed Quadrophenia. Yes, indeed. That's the first movie I ever did, Quadrophenia. That was way back in 79. I'm very briefly in it. It's an interesting movie, though.
Well, just, I guess the reason that I'm curious about what I ask is, I'm curious about what the experience of working with or being around Ken Russell was like.
Well, it was fantastic. I mean, you always had a sense of danger. I mean, as a man, he's a fascinating man. You know, he he's a very, you know, he had such a reputation for making some extraordinary movies, and that this reputation of being a colourful and slightly eccentric or cruel and mad is the word, I think, director. But he turned out actually to be kind of a bit scary, because there's something a bit volatile about him, but actually a very, very a very, very conscientious director, knowing how much time he had within the budget constraints and the schedule. It was quite a revelation to see someone who has this reputation for being a firebrand and a loose cannon actually got the film done in time and on budget. And it was a wonderful experience. It was wonderful cast. That was Julian Sands and Natasha Richardson and the wonderful Irish actor. Oh, I can't remember. It'll kill me if he's listening. I'm sure he is. Gabriel Byrne.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. It was a wonderful experience. And we were out in the Lake District of England pretending to be all these mad, stoned poets charging about the town, you know, doing various nefarious and blasphemous things, you know, to create these great Gothic novels that appeared from one particular party, which was one big knees up and laudanum-induced party down in Lake Diodati in 17-something or other.
Well, we have a caller here. Why don't we talk with him? Somebody who's listening in Charleston, which is not all that far away. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I would actually like to hear pretty much anything Mr. Spall has to say about what is probably my favorite movie, Topsy Turvy.
Ah, well, that's interesting. That's a great... Well, thank you for that being your favourite movie. That was a... That's a Mike Lee movie, which is all... I don't know if the audience knows, the listeners know, is all about the making of The Mikado, which Gilbert and Sullivan... was one of their greatest successes, and it's a backstage story about the making of that. And it actually surprised people immensely that Mike Lee would come up with something like that. Most of his fare being based on what I've explained earlier about, you know, working class families are living, you know, on the breadline. But it was a tremendous experience. It always is when you work with Mike Lee. The biggest departure on this was that we were actually playing, some of us were playing people that actually existed. So we had to go and find out about them, what we could, and then try and put the meat of... you know, wrap them around ourselves and then invent more. What we didn't know, we had to invent more. And a lot of the emotional stuff came out of the fact that the Victorians were very good at being private. They never really left you much information about what they got up to. So some of the, you know, like my character's sensitivity and his humility, we found out that the guy that I played, the real character, had a nervous breakdown, which opened up the door of feeling that maybe there was a sensitive soul. And we worked a lot on that, on his internal side, how he felt and how he actually got through life. And, you know, so subsequently, everybody was doing that individually on the other character. So you get this amazing picture, this almost photograph of Victorian theatrical life, with also underpinned by this lagoon of emotion that you can dip into when you're creating three-dimensional characters.
That's fascinating. I'm curious what you brought of yourself to that role of an actor playing an actor.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, that character, Richard Temple, he's far fayer than me and far more given to theatrical sort of demeanor, really. Although, I mean, all actors, I think, understand other actors. I mean, if you get keep your mind open. So, you know, it was a great chance to bring out all of that camp theatricality that I'm not saying I have to repress or suppress, but it was great to be able to do that and base that on various people that I've encountered and often encounter in the theatre and so forth. What you've got to remember, and Mike Lee said to me this about theatricality, he said, the great thing about theatricality is that it's totally organic and natural in the theatre. So therefore, it isn't pretentious. If solicitors and electricians start going around theatrically, then it is pretentious. But theatricals can be theatrical.
That makes perfect sense,
yeah.
Especially thinking back to the movie, and just it brought the whole world of, well, not the whole world, of course, but it brought a glimpse into the Victorian theatre that I don't think really is available anywhere else.
No, I think you're right, and I think it was, I don't know, we tapped into something there, and that enabled us to really investigate what it, you know, what it takes, I mean, what it actually takes or took to put on a show, you know, in that period. And I mean, it's a play really about what it takes to make a piece of collaborative art, you know, like a film or a play or anything that's a collaborative thing. I think it's an homage to that, really. And it happens also to be a great investigation of the mores and the attitudes and the etiquette of the Victorian age and how the repression of the age still didn't keep down the sort of emotional quality of the people and that made it more like, you know, contained, therefore more intriguing, that it's not, there's not a great deal of expression, it's all underneath.
I think that's absolutely right, and I thank you for your performance. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's very kind of you. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you for the call. We're about a midway through here talking with Timothy Spall. He's a long time been an actor in film and television and on the stage. He made a number of movies with the British director Mike Leigh. The one we just were talking about here, Topsy Turvy, also Secrets and Lies, Life is Sweet, All or Nothing. He also appeared in Hamlet, a 1996 version directed by Ken Branagh, and which is the first film in this year's Roger Ebert's Film Festival. That'll be shown tonight at 7 o'clock up at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. And if you don't get a chance to see it there, you certainly can't see it. It is available on DVD. He also, our guest, Timothy Spall, also has performed in a lot of other movies, including The Sheltering Sky, Vanilla Sky, Rockstar, The Last Samurai, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, as well as The Goblet of Fire, and will be in a couple of the forthcoming films. He was in Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events, in Enchanted, a recent Disney feature, was in Tim Burton's recent version of Sweeney Todd, and also in a new version of A Room with a View that was just shown on public television. A lot of folks, I expect, listening to us or who watch our TV station saw that. And he's here in town to take part in the festival. We're glad he could spend a little time talking with us. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line if you'd like to call in. And the call will be on us. That's 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana, here where we are. Line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask your guest about his thoughts on Andrew Davies as a screenwriter, or that what he's done is to sort of modernize a lot of the Victorian stories. You know, A Room with a View, he wrote the script for that, and Pride and Prejudice and all. And I guess I'm just curious about his thoughts on making classic literature sort of appealing to a modern audience, you know, like he was just talking about the restraint of the Victorian society and how you didn't talk all about what you were doing. But I thought it was wonderful in both Pride and Prejudice, the 1994 or 5 version, and also in the recent Room with a View, how he and other actors were able to give you that sense of passion without being overly passionate, if that makes any sense. But just the whole idea of Andrew Davies as a screenwriter who's trying to make all of this literature relevant to contemporary society, whether he thinks anything's lost by that or, you know, gained or...
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. It's, you know, any adaptation of a classic novel, it, you know, has to be really adapted completely and utterly for the screen. I mean, the great thing about what you're saying, you know, in reference to the repression and so on of Victorian life, the great thing about Victorian and Edwardian novels is the density of the writing and the suggestion and the way they explain, and the narrative is so thick and so dense, and that, you know, when that has to But and a lot of it, obviously, is telling the story, because you're getting into the mind and the soul of the characters via the author's explanation. Of course, when you adapt it to television or for the screen, you really can't afford to have that, because it becomes so pedestrian and it holds it back. So I think Andrew Davis's great skill is taking the essence of those characters, the theatricality, and don't mean in a actorly way. I mean the theatrical narrative of that story that creates the drama in the novel. A lot of the drama in novels is so protracted and long and convoluted. I think what Andrew Davis's genius is bringing that and condensing the pertinent dramatic moments and underpinning it with sometimes his own augmentation of, shall we say, the private preoccupations of the characters. He teases them up to make them more relevant. So if there is a suggestion of something sexual or something nefarious or perverted in the character, he'll leave you in no doubt that that is what is in the back of their mind. Whereas in the novel, obviously, it's the suggestion and the density and the sort of almost the denial within a lot of the writing, or the merest suggestion, that makes it, you know, something you understand. Whereas, although I'm not accusing him of being unsubtle, he's not. He makes that more dramatic. You know, he is untrammeled by the restrictions of that period. Now, some may say that sometimes that's lost, that loses some of that repression that created the motion in the first place. But I think he's very good at keeping the balance. And obviously the Victorian novel, the novelists and Edwardian novelists couldn't write about what they, you know, about what actually went on behind closed doors after the moment, after the first kiss. You know, so I think given the license of a modern day, perspective and perception and allowances, I think he tends to grab at that and to make it more relevant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And other questions, calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, I think that we have the idea now, whether it's true or not, you can tell me, but we have the idea that British actors and American actors work very differently, and that American actors, particularly those people who have been schooled in the method, are what they're doing, or what they think they're doing, is that they're becoming another person, and that British actors are always aware of the fact that, well, they're still themselves. They're not becoming another person. What they're doing is they're pretending to be another person. But it doesn't go quite to that same depth of transformation that maybe some American actors would at least say that's what we're aiming to do. Do you, in fact, think that kind of characterization about the way that American actors and British actors work is really true? Is that the way it is?
It's an interesting thought. It's an interesting question. I think there are drama schools. There's the Drama Centre, which is one of the main drama schools of London. Actually, does teach Stanislavski, and you know, it does use that as part of its training. So it's not completely separated by the Atlantic, you know. But I think, I mean, to me, I'm not a great student of Stanislavski. I don't really. I get the principle of it, although I think basically any actor that is using their intelligence and using their powers of empathy and their understanding of trying to become the character or portray the character is using the same. It's the same idea. You are transforming yourself and becoming that character, whether you're acting it or whether you're doing it. I mean, even though in the method you are becoming the character, you're still acting it, because if your character is volatile and would never walk in a straight line and stand and pick something off a shelf because you are so engrossed in the character. And the director says, well, I think we should have this character walk up here, stand here and get the... he picks this up and then you'll be in a massive close-up. The actor who's so completely in character will have to do it because it's a technical exercise as well. Plus, if the director says, okay, you do what you like, but you're going to be at the back of this shot, and this person here who says isn't saying anything is in the front of it, and they're going to get the close-up, the method actor would be come up there, stand on the mark, and take the thing off the top of the wardrobe. So, you know, I'm not in any way disparaging the method, because I think it's a tremendous thing, and I think it has a lot to offer, and it did revolutionise a lot of bad, should we say, generalised theatrical acting and standing up and showing off, basically, in the cult of just turning up and being a personality. But I think, you know, any actor that's got that is in it to do it well and to the best of their abilities and use the full the full basket of their imagination tends to use the method in one way or another anyway, because you've got to work out and somehow wear the personality, the psyche of that character on you when you're portraying it. And then obviously you've got to then walk down, turn left and pick up the chair without falling over, you know. So it's always going to be a mixture of a technical exercise and a form of inhabiting a real person.
I read one of the articles that I read. There was a great story in there about how, and this was from a few years ago, I guess. The story was that your youngest daughter wouldn't sit and watch television with you because you'd sit there and you'd rant at the screen and you'd complain about the quality of acting. What is it that
sounds terrible, doesn't it? But I'm afraid it's, it's true.
Well, and what's actually then what really struck me and that I really liked was then also I came across a quote from your son.
Yeah.
Who said that he actually felt that he learned some things about acting sitting there with you watching television and listening to you complain about the quality.
Well, I have to admit, I am a terrible ranter about things, and I have personal, really personal hates of certain types of television and so on and so forth. I mean, I should just go out of the room, really, shouldn't I? maybe I like it, but I do. I think, you know. He has listened to me for 25 years, and also if something's really good, you know, he's seen me cry at people and he's seen me go, "That's fantastic! That is, you know, this is brilliant." They when they were kids, they had this. They used to take the mick out of me because they cottoned on to me once. I was slagging something off on television, but I said at one point. Because I was watching another adaptation of a classic, I said, "Oh, this is so much better than Middlemarch." And every time I was about to say anything, and they still say it, just about to rant, they say, "Oh, this is so much better than Middlemarch."
That's the problem with kids. See, they're paying attention and they're taking notes and stuff like that. Stuff will come back to haunt you.
It will indeed. But the thing is that I was so pleased when Rafe said that, Rafe, because the thing is that I've never stood him up and said, "Do this, do that, this is how you act." You can't teach anybody really how to act. You can free them up and give them the chance to experience and do stuff, but you can't teach it, you know. You can open the mind, but so it may be a bit of quality control, unreasonable, you know, but quality control may have helped. But I would never slag anybody off or any art, any what thing in public, because I don't believe in it. Because even if it's things I don't like, sometimes these are actors are working hard in things that they don't have the time and the chance to, you know, to investigate these things, and they're earning a living. So I would never denigrate what they do. Really, it's just personal, you know.
Our guest is Timothy Spall. He's acted in many films, in television, comedy, and drama, and also on the stage. And some of his films just recently include a version of Room with View that was shown on public television, in which he acted with his son, Rafe. Also, Tim Burton's recent version of Sweeney Todd, the Disney feature Enchanted. He's been in a couple of the Harry Potter movies. He was in Lemony Snicket's Series of Unfortunate Events. He has also been in some big Hollywood films. He was in The Last Samurai, Rock star Vanilla Sky, acted in several films with Mike Lee, and also in Hamlet of 1996, directed by Ken Branagh, which is the opening film of Roger Ebert's film festival. That'll be shown tonight at 7 at the Virginia Theater. And, of course, you can't go and see it there. You can see it. You can rent it on DVD and watch it whenever you like. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think and maybe this has always been the case, that there are actors that can disappear into a do a pretty good job of disappearing into a role, and then there are movie stars. And there are some people even who can inhabit a ground in between. You have somebody like, for example, Johnny Depp, who is a movie star, but I think can do pretty good job at disappearing into the role. At least he's not one of those actors, when you see them on the screen, all you see is the actor. You have a hard time seeing the character. The actor comes through too much. And that gets at the question, you know, if for people who can do that, that is actors who can do that, really manage to try to erase themselves to some extent and then really embody that character so that you see the character, not the actor. How exactly do you do that? Or do you know, is that something that you could tell someone how to do?
I don't think you can tell them how to do it. And I agree with you. Johnny Depp is a tremendous example of somebody who is both a film star, you know, and a chameleon, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think I've always thought that if you get your priorities right, which is it's your job as an actor to serve the character, not yourself. So basically, if you put the character before you, if you look at it and say, right, what are the preoccupations of this character? If he's from this part of the world, how did he speak? And why do people speak like that? There's a rhythm to that, the way they speak. You think you have to think about what has made him, if he's a pariah, or is an unpopular character, or is a pain in the butt. Why is he a pain in the butt? So you start building up layers of all these things, and you start experimenting with where he's from, why he's like he is, what made him like that, what are his preoccupations, what are his deepest fears, all those things. That it's just like trying to work out, it's like being a psychologist, really, of trying to work out what is making someone tick. And then it's your job to try and inhabit that, you know, and try and put that on the screen or on stage without it looking like you're doing it. And I think that is a mixture of imagination, having a bit of bravery, trying out maybe a way of speaking that someone speaks. You know, take, for instance, Dan Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. Mm-hmm. He had a very peculiar way of delivering the lines. And I think it was a fantastic thing, because he was totally in the character, but he was speaking like a man from another time. And there was something oddly in denial about this kind of patrician, almost strong, straightforward way of delivering the lines, but underneath this kind of seething resentment and this sense of being rejected. And you know, so you get this wonderful juxtapositioning of someone who has almost a kind of noble exterior, but a very weak and sensitive interior. So all of these juxtapositions, these contradictions that people have in their lives, you know, the way that these uber-confident people, you can catch a look of sensitivity in their eye, and vice versa, people who are very meek, very, you know, wouldn't say boo to a goose, would never be proactive in any way, they can surprise you. You've got to always look for the interesting, look for the extraordinary in the ordinary. And I think you're on your way to trying to work out, you know, how people tick, really, and then just try and portray them to the best of your ability, serving them, and not for you to show off and show that the audience what a marvelous actor you are, but basically you're bringing them the character, and they should forget how if you're doing it well, that you are doing it well. I mean, a lot of the times, I think that's why a lot of great performances that are understated don't win awards. Often people with the limps and the funny, you know, the mental deficiency and so on, they do because people say, oh, that is tremendous acting, where there's thousands and thousands of actors who have given great performances that are totally understated, but they're, you, because they're good, no one notices that they're acting.
Mm. One of the things I'm sure that's really challenging about acting in film is that you have to spend a lot of time sitting around waiting for the people who do all the other parts, the people who do the who set things up and who do the lighting and who make sure that everything is going to look good while everybody's doing their thing and getting ready to do the shot. You're sitting someplace waiting until they say, okay, Mr. Spall, now it's time for you to come and do your thing. And you may be in front of the camera for, I don't know, it could be for a period of minutes or maybe an hour than along in that. And then
you're
they'll say,
okay, 6 weeks off.
And okay, we're done with you. You can go now because we've got to set up for the next shot. How do you manage to hold on to the character, and then every time that you come back after you've not been in front of the camera and going off and having lunch or, you know, sitting around waiting for them to call you back, how do you manage to keep hold of what it is that you're doing?
Well, I think, you know, given that film and television is all, you know, 99.9% made out of sequence. You know, you're never going to do a scene followed by the scene after it, unless in very rare occasions when the director will say, no, we must do that next because it's emotionally it's very important. But that very rarely happens. So when you're working on a script, you're keeping the entire character in your head. But you've got to try and keep the sort of storyline in your head. And it becomes a mixed-up jigsaw. But you should be able to, at any one point, because you've done the work on it, know where that fits. You can't mess about and go, oh, could somebody tell me, oh, didn't I, oh, I was a bit sad a minute ago. You've got to keep that whole character within your head, in a sense, like a broken-up jigsaw, which you know you can put back together. And it's a sort of abstract thing. It's like saying, oh, well, you learn your entire part. It's not like that. Because also, when you're going along, you're learning and developing each time you go on and do a scene. You know, the thing in your head and the way it turns out might be different. So it's a mixture of the two, actually. You've got to keep a jigsaw of intent and understanding and storyline, which, you know, you do that by just reading a script again, you know, and then just, you know, knowing where you stand in it. And then you have to sort of know where you're coming from and at what point your emotion is. It's wonderful when you see actors doing that. You know, I love it when I see actors who have, you know, done a scene in the morning where they've laughed and joked and everything's hunky-dory, and then you'll do a scene in the afternoon and where straight on action they have to come in wrecked and, destroyed because part of the script has destroyed the character's emotions, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what actors get paid for, really. So, you know, as I say, it's a collaborative thing as well. And so the difference between when you're doing a big studio movie, the time scale is very, very long. So you have to keep that concentration in your head for longer. And there is many distractions, of course. But on a low-budget movie, you know, sometimes you'll shoot a low-budget movie, and I have done on occasions, in 3 weeks. You know, it's still an hour and a half movie, but, you know, an average feature film will take about 16 weeks, and an average studio movie will take about 16 weeks to shoot, and a low-budget independent will be between 3 and 5 weeks. So, the concentration and the speed helps you to keep that concentration more. So you know, you get it. It's sometimes more gratifying to do a low budget movie because you're chasing it. Whereas, you know, these longueurs and these great moments that you mentioned in between, in between building your character within the plot, within the story, you have to keep certain that your concentration is there and you know what you're doing. You can't get caught out otherwise, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time here. Maybe you have about a minute or so left. Let me ask you this. For somebody like you who has been in as many movies and television shows, anonymity is not going to be an option. People, you walk down the street, as you say, people know who you are. And at the same time, it strikes me, at least from what I've read about you, it makes it sound as if you have managed to have something like a normal life. One wonders, as someone who is that well known, you know, we've seen a lot of people whose fame seems to have destroyed them.
Yeah.
That seems not to have been the case with you. You seem managed to have managed with that pretty well. Not that, you know, I'm sure people have photographers have stalked you as well. But
I've got one of those very ignorable faces, though. But no, a long time ago, when I was 24, to go back full circle, when we were talking about that TV show that I did, it was a shock. To the loss of anonymity was overnight almost, and it was a great shock. And some of my friends were freaked out by it. But I made a conscious decision that I would not go around feeling conspicuous. And I think the more conspicuous you feel, you know, the fact if you're wearing a pair of sunglasses in a supermarket and a hat and a beard, you know, hang on a minute, who's the guy in the hat and the beard in the supermarket? You know, what's he doing? It's not cold and it's bright in here. So you're going to draw attention, and the entourage that comes before you often, you know, there are ways of keeping your head down, really, and going about your business. And obviously, every now and again, you know, I seem to be having pretty free time of it down, walking through Champagne and Urbano. I don't occasionally get a funny look, but and a couple of people have nodded and smiled or laughed squarely in my face. But I think the less you worry about it, the less noticeable you are. The more you worry about it, the more, in a sense, the more you're going to attract. So I just try and get on with it, you know. Mm. Otherwise, you know, you've got to, because, you know, as I've been wafting on about the importance of portraying what it is to be human, you can't not be a part of the world and go out there and try and portray it. You've got to somehow function within it. Otherwise, you're just not going to be a real person, I don't think.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest is Timothy Spall. You can see, go on to wherever it is you rent your movies, and you can see many of his films. He's here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in Roger Ebert's Film Festival. The first film is Hamlet, showing tonight at 7 o'clock. He performs in that, directed by Ken, starring in Ken Branagh. And Mr. Spall, thanks very much.
No, thank you. Nice to talk to you.